Civil rights advocates are warning of the dangers of suppressing pro-Palestinian speech in the midst of what some see as Israel's genocidal violence against the people of Gaza after a major attack on Israel by Gaza's ruling party, Hamas. Arun Kudnani has written about the Israeli-Palestine conflict for The Nation, The Guardian, The Washington Post, and The Intercept. He spoke with KGVM contributor David Rosenberg.
So censorship of Palestinian views, how prevalent is that, do you think? And is it getting worse? Or has it gotten worse in the last couple of weeks?
It has been a major problem. And right now in the United States is, you know, at least some of the major social media platforms having a very deliberate policy of censoring posts that are pro-Palestinian. There seems to be a particular problem with Facebook and Instagram owned by Meta. We're also seeing demands from employers that people lose their jobs if they are posting on social media in support of the rights of Palestinians. We've seen a law student at New York University lose her job offer already. That's the one case that we certainly know about. We've seen demands for students in Harvard University to be kind of blacklisted for potential jobs they might be applying for. So that's the picture in the United States. In Europe, the situation is actually even more striking in some ways. We have in Germany and France, any demonstration that supports the rights of the Palestinians has been banned. The Home Secretary in Britain has said that if you wear a Palestinian scarf or wave a Palestinian flag, that might be a criminal offense in itself.
This sounds almost kind of nutty. I mean, this is just seriously extreme. Have we seen anything like this before directed against any other group?
We've seen this in the past. The atmosphere in some ways is reminiscent of the early years of the war on terror. I mean, I think what it tells us is that defenders of Israel feel like they're losing the argument, right? They can't win the argument through open debate anymore and feel the need to use their ability to influence governments to pass legislation and take these kind of measures, using their power as employers and so on to censor instead of to try and win the argument for an open debate. And that's, you know, I think it's been striking actually after the kind of initial few days where the dominant message, I think, in the public debate in the United States was, you know, we stand with Israel and so on. In the last few days, I think the mood has shifted and more people are seeing that what we're looking at right now is the potential for what could well be a genocidal assault on Gaza, but certainly war crimes on a large scale committed by Israel. It's necessary for everyone to take a stand against that. And, you know, the arguments that are being mobilized to justify it from the Israeli side are transparently unconvincing.
There are Palestinian organizations in the U.S. and in European countries. There are organizations on college campuses. So as far as you know, has there been any attempt to crack down on the existence of those organizations?
Well,
is the thrust more to just make sure they're not too public about their support of Palestine?
Yes. So at this point, I think that the main burden is to use the control of social media, use the control of jobs and so on to impose an attempt to weaken one side in the debate, the Palestinian side in the debate. We have, though, seen, you know, FBI agents turn up at quite a few people's homes over the last few days in the United States, questioning people who are affiliated with the Palestinian cause, you know, civil activists in the United States. So again, that's reminiscent of that moment in the early period of the war on terror where, you know, huge numbers of Muslim Americans had that knock on the door from the FBI agent.
I guess some of the pro-Israel people are likening the Hamas attack to the 9/11 attack. Is that right?
Yeah, that lines that's come from the Israeli side that, you know, that this is their 9/11. And I don't think that analogy really makes sense. Hamas is not Al-Qaeda, and the circumstances of the two moments are radically different in that sense. But where there is, I think, some similarity is, you know, if you remember after 9/11 in the United States, things moved very quickly to a new kind of set of norms about what the limits of acceptability were. So anyone in the days after 9/11 who tried to say there's another side to what 9/11 was about, that, and you know, even while we deplore what happened in those attacks, we can also at the same time talk about the historical conditions that created the situation where some people decided to carry out the 9/11 attacks, right? So you know, that broader conversation was shut down, and that, you know, that happened within a matter of days. In those first immediate period after 9/11, it was just impossible. Anyone who tried to sort of tell a different side to it was immediately denounced as an apologist for terrorism. And that then, you know, in those first couple of weeks, that then set the terms for the subsequent years. And then, you know, those of us who were opposed to the Afghanistan war and to the Iraq war were always kind of fighting from the back foot, as it were, to try and to make those arguments, because, you know, a particular way of thinking had already been established as the only acceptable story. Now, they have tried to do that this week. They've tried to say that anyone who wants to talk about a context or a history to Hamas's attacks last week is somehow complicit with terrorism and so on. But actually, this time it hasn't worked so well. I think
they are talking about the suffering that is happening in Gaza. You know, all the people being killed and wounded and having to flee. So there is that part that's getting covered.
Absolutely, that's right. And I think that wasn't the case a week ago, and that's being forced on to the agenda by the large numbers of people, even in the United States, who wanted those issues raised, right? And I think to some extent we've done a good job over the last 10, 15 years or so to be able to kind of get a little bit closer to, you know, to a kind of level playing field in terms of the competing narratives on this issue. And so, you know, that's given us the ability to have a line where we can now say the context for what's happening, the unavoidable context for what's happening, is a military occupation carried out by Israel. And as, you know, the Israeli newspaper Haaretz pointed out, therefore, whatever happens in this conflict, there is an immediate responsibility on the perpetrators of violence, but there's also a responsibility on Israel itself as the military occupying power. And therefore, you know, this is not a battle of good versus evil. This is not a battle of, you know, Israel as a representative of Western values against the barbarism of the Palestinians. That's not the story here. And I think more and more people understand that. You know, this is a story of a colonial project, a military occupation, an apartheid system, and people trying to fight back against that in ways that sometimes we might find deplorable. But nevertheless, the power relationship here is one of a colonial project and an apartheid project.
Now, there have been pro-Palestinian demonstrations across the country. I know probably in some countries they've been banned, but here you do see them, and there does seem to be some political space to operate here. You even see some, occasional sympathetic coverage in the media.
It's few and far between, isn't it? But you know, I mean, I think the dominant picture in the media is still very much, you know, on the pro-Israeli side. And we had, if you've been watching CNN, then it's incredibly centered on the notion of Israel as the victim.
It seems like, you know, there's a real free speech issue here. And could Palestinian groups take the issue to court if their free speech is being suppressed?
I mean, I think there's certainly going to be possible legal avenues for people who, you know, have been offered a job, as we've been hearing about, people who've been offered a job and then express an opinion in support of Palestine and find that job is rescinded, you know, that job offer is rescinded. In those kind of circumstances, it seems like there would be some kind of possible legal remedy. You know, I think we're seeing in academia directives coming from university management telling academics, you know, that they're not allowed to post things on social media that are supportive of Palestine. I think we're seeing the same stuff coming from some news organizations in relation to their employees. Now, it seems to me that, yes, there is certainly a First Amendment potential challenge to those kinds of directives as well.
Any note of optimism that you can give us?
I don't know that there's much optimism at this point in the immediate future. I feel that, you know, the large numbers of people that are coming out onto the streets in the United States, the attempts to, you know, take some kind of direct action to prevent, well, the direct action, at least to highlight the different corporations that supply weapons to Israel. You know, those kind of things I think are incredibly valuable, crucial at the moment. The growing number of people who are contacting their elected representatives to demand that we end our unconditional support for Israel militarily and financially. I think more and more people are learning about the history here and understanding that there is another narrative to the one that they've typically only heard one side of a story before, and they're learning the other side and finding it actually to be compelling, because people understand that in a situation of military occupation, people will fight back and people will have a right to defend themselves in that situation. And I think that is something that, that increasingly is unarguable, and the Israeli side is certainly on the back foot in terms of the public debate. Whether that translates into different policies, that's the struggle that we face over the coming weeks and months and years, is to move the US from this position of complete unconditional support to a position where Israel is forced to engage in a political settlement with the other parties to the conflict.
Do you get the impression that many of the pro-Israel people sincerely believe that the Israelis just want to live in peace and the Palestinians just keep attacking them, and if they would just stop attacking, then there could be real peace in the Middle East?
I mean, I think for many people who are just ordinary people who are supportive of Israel, that's a sincerely held belief. I think for the political leadership in Israel, the position is the current status quo is perfect for them. The sort of vague rhetoric that at some point in an undefined future there might be some kind of settlement, but for now, you know, the apartheid system continues, the imprisonment of Gaza continues, the bombing continues as and when Israel feels the need to deploy it, and the settlements continue to be built. And, you know, for most Israelis, they're not living in a situation as they might have been in the past, where they might fear bombs going off in cafes and things like that. That has been the status quo up until just over a week ago, right? And so I think that status quo was attractive to the political leadership. It seemed like the Zionist project could comfortably continue on those terms. I think what's happened in the last week is that that expectation has been by actions of Hamas. And so everything's up in the air right now. I don't think the political leadership in Israel know where they're going at this point. You know, supporters of Israel in the United States, some of whom are, you know, are highly ideological, but others are just kind of, you know, expressing the things they've been brought up with, the views they've been brought up with.
Are they kind of what one Israeli writer called not so much Zionists, but Israelists? They don't really subscribe to Zionist ideology, but they just want Israel to survive, that kind of thing?
I think there's something in that. I think there's a battle going on amongst Jewish Americans right now, right? It's a battle over what it means to be Jewish in the end. And on one side of that battle is an idea that, you know, Jews will never be safe unless Israel continues to exist. And
although you could easily argue the opposite.
Well, I mean, I think the argument falls apart as soon as you examine it. But I think there are significant numbers of people who sincerely hold that argument. And you know, and I think when they're confronted with the count, you know, they basically can no longer hold on to their views, you know, in a way that would be plausible even to them. And so they have to conclude that the people making those arguments aren't serious and can only be motivated by anti-Semitism, which is why the charge of anti-Semitism becomes so central to these debates.
Anything else you want to add to what you said?
I think, you know, right now we've seen the racially motivated murder of a six-year-old in Illinois by someone who felt that, you know, that all Palestinians needed to be killed, and had a Palestinian tenant family and went in there with a knife and killed a six-year-old and injured the six-year-old's mother. I think that is the end result of the violence that we're seeing from Israel, right? Then the whole rhetoric that we're seeing from Israel. This is a moment where genocide is being openly talked about, and that is playing out in the United States in smaller ways, but ways that are real enough here as well.
Arun Kudnani is the author of What Is Anti-Racism? And The Muslims Are Coming. He spoke with KGVM contributor David Rosenberg. This interview was released on October 17th, 2023.